in the pub. So I took my cash and my guitar, and I pitched up in a dark corner and had a couple of pints. Not many, just enough to keep me warm for the rest of the night. I stayed there until they closed, because it was somewhere dry. It was raining that night, so when I got back, everybody was huddled up inside the burnt-out buildings. We don't usually go in there much, because it's not safe. Wind hits that place in the right direction, and huge chunks of the roof cave in. I was running across the car park to the building when I saw Robert in his sleeping bag. He always slept in the same place, every night, unless it was raining. I wondered if he'd had some drinks too, and he didn't realize it was raining, so I went over to wake him. His eyes and mouth were open, and he was blue. I knew he was dead. I ran to the phone box on the corner, and I dialed 999. I didn't notice anything else, because his sleeping bag was zipped all the way up to his neck. That's the last I saw of him. Max suddenly broke off and looked down, his clasped hands pressed tightly against his lips. Julia reached out and rested her hand on the young man's shoulder, giving it a reassuring squeeze. He looked up and smiled appreciatively, appearing to be holding back his tears. "Can you show me where he was sleeping, when you found him?" Julia asked. "Maybe there's something the police missed." I thought the cops back home were a joke, but yours really do, what's the expression, take the biscuit? It was just over there, next to that empty gas canister. Mac cast a finger along the metal fence to a spot only a couple of feet away. Thanking him for his help, she walked over to the red, upturned canister next to the fence. She scanned the ground, but there were no signs of anything out of the ordinary. She imagined the poor man dead in his sleeping bag, and her chest tightened. Closing her eyes for a moment, she inhaled deeply, before looking over her shoulder to Jesse and Tommy. They were both deep in conversation, huge smiles on their faces. Julia looked ahead through the fence panels. An unlit path ran along the side of the industrial park, winding out of view. Pushing her hands up against the fence, she tried to see where it went. As she did, the metal slats moved under her touch. She jumped back and frowned at the fence. She ran her fingers along the panels. All of them were securely in place, apart from two that had been unscrewed at the bottom. Parting the slats, she pushed her leg through, and then her torso. Julia wasn't a big woman, but she was 15 to 20 pounds above average, depending on the time of year. She slipped through the opening in the fence with ease. "Are you making a bid for freedom?" Tommy asked, startling her. Julia slid back through the fence and crouched down to look at the missing bolts that allowed the fence panels to move. She ran her fingers along the holes, noticing how fresh the metal underneath looked. It appeared as though the bolts hadn't been missing for long. "How long has this fence been like this?" Julia asked Tommy, who was standing behind her with Jesse. "Is it important?" Jesse looked down her nose at Julia as she examined the ground around the fence. "I don't know," Julia mumbled, tapping her chin. "Maybe, maybe not."
"I couldn't tell you, truth be told," Tommy said with a frown, as he leaned his entire body weight on his stick. "Why do you ask?"
"Where was Bailey when he found him?" Julia asked, pushing herself up from the ground and brushing the creases out of her peacoat.
"Just here," Tommy said,
walking a couple of feet down the fence and tapping his stick on the ground.
"He was facing into the fence. What are you thinking, Julia?"
"Nothing," Julia said, forcing a smile, not wanting to give Tommy false hope. "I'm just overthinking things."
"There's a suit van," Jessie said, hooking her thumb over her shoulder to a food truck that had pulled up outside of the entrance of the industrial park.
"Stella and Max from the soup kitchen always bring their leftovers at this time of night, and there's always plenty to go round."
"Sounds good to me," Julia said with a nod. "Lead the way."
As they joined the end of the long line for soup, Julia glanced over her shoulder at the fence, knowing it was more than possible for somebody to sneak in during the night to kill homeless people.
Looking at Mac as he strummed away peacefully on his guitar, she wondered what could possibly motivate somebody to do such a terrible thing.
Chapter 5.
Later that week, Julia found herself sitting at Barker's dining room table for a second attempt of their ruined picnic date. The bought sandwiches were gone, replaced with the rich and hearty scent of beef stew drifting through from the kitchen as Barker topped up their wine glasses. "I see you've unpacked," Julia said, motioning through the archway to the living room, which had still been full of boxes on her last visit. "It's starting to feel a little homelier around here."
"Well, I figured if I was sticking around in the village, I had to stop living out of boxes."
Barker sipped his wine, his eyes twinkling in the flickering candlelight. "I'd like to think I've put my own touch on the place." Julia looked around the cottage, which was still quite bare compared to her own. The furniture was white and sterile, more suited to a city apartment than a Cotswold cottage. That juxtaposition matched Barker's presence in the village, but both seemed to work. Barker hurried off to the kitchen and returned with two large bowls filled to the brim with rich, bubbling beef stew. He had splashed the gravy all down the sides of the white bowl and slapped the dish on the table without a placemat. It wasn't exactly how Julia would do things, but she appreciated the effort all the same. "This smells delicious for a man who claimed not to be able to cook," Julia said as she leaned into the steaming bowl.
"This is one of the few things my old mum taught me," Barker said as he topped up their already full wine glasses again. "You fry some onions and garlic, toss in some bacon and beef, add the stock, a glug or three of red wine, and then you throw the whole thing in a slow cooker for the best part of a day. Idiot-proof."
Julia skimmed her spoon across the top of the stew and sampled Barker's creation. It tasted as delicious as it smelled, and the red wine definitely shone through.
"Tell me more about your mother," Julia asked, as they started to tuck into their food. "You've never spoken about her before."
Barker smiled sadly down into his stew. Just from the slight crease between his brows, she could sense that Barker's mother was in the same place as her own. "She died 5 years ago," Barker said, dropping his spoon and leaning across the table towards Julia. "She was a remarkable woman. She swore like a sailor, but she had a heart of gold. She wasn't a woman many people would dare cross, because she would let them know about it. She raised me and my brothers single-handedly, and she never once complained."
"I'm sad I couldn't meet her. She sounds great."
"She would have loved you," Barker said with a warm smile, his eyes sparkling. "She had a sweet tooth like nobody I've ever met, so you two would have gotten on like a house on fire."
"What was her favourite cake?"
"She couldn't say no to a coconut cake," Barker said with a small sigh. "I haven't had one since her funeral. The whole buffet at the funeral was cakes. We know she would have loved that."
Julia made a mental note to dig through her own mother's handwritten recipe books, because she was sure she had come across a coconut cake recipe in her time. Barker was more of a double chocolate cake type of man, but she knew it would bring a smile to his face. She liked hearing about his life, even if it did make her realise how little she knew the village's new detective inspector.
"Are you close to your brothers?" Julia asked, already feeling full but barely making a dent in her overflowing stew.
"As close as a group of men with their own careers can be," Barker said, pausing to sip his wine. "I'm a baby of four, and I'm the only bachelor in the family, which only becomes more apparent at family parties. They've all got wives, and between them they've given me 9 nieces and nephews. Keeps Christmas expensive."
"Have you never thought about having kids?"
"I did," Barker said with a firm nod, "once upon a time."
Julia sensed some sadness in his words. Were they connected to a previous relationship? She almost asked, but she bit her tongue, remembering she still hadn't told Barker that she was technically still in the middle of her divorce. She'd finally signed her papers and sent them off to her solicitor. But she was still waiting to hear if their decree absolute had been granted. Gerard had been the one pushing the process along ever since changing the locks of their London apartment, and politely informing her he was leaving her for his 27-year-old secretary. But she wouldn't put it past him to start dragging his heels in the final stages. She decided that was a can of worms better left sealed.
"What about you?" Barker asked. "Do you see kids on the horizon?"
The question caught Julia off guard. As a young woman, she had just assumed she would one day have a big family. But, like Barker, it just hadn't worked out that way.
"I don't know," Julia answered honestly. "Life has a funny way of throwing things at you, don't you think? I certainly never expected to be fostering a teenager, or dating a detective inspector."
"What you've done with Jesse is an amazing thing," Barker said sincerely. "You should be really proud of yourself. Not many would be as understanding as you have been. How's the fostering process going?"
"Slow," Julia said, pushing her half-finished bowl away from her. "They've granted me temporary fostering rights because she's a young adult and settled, but it's a slow process. We're still waiting for anything official."
"What about when she turns 18? Barker asked, copying Julia and pushing away his barely touched stew. "What are you going to do with her?"
"She's not an old couch," Julia replied coolly, arching a brow. "I'm not just going to kick her out."
"I wouldn't expect you to," Barker held up his hands before topping up their wine again.
"I suppose I'll let Jessie decide what she wants to do. My guest bedroom isn't going anywhere, and neither is my cafe, so I'm here for her as long as she wants me."
"You're a good woman, Julia." Barker smiled softly over the rim of his wine glass. "If the world was filled with more Julias, it would be a better place."
"I'm nothing special," Julia mumbled, ruffling her hair as she felt her cheeks blush. "I'm just a plain old baker."
"You're anything but plain, Julia. You're so much more than that."
Julia smiled and met Barker's eyes through the candlelight. He reached out and rested his hand upon hers. It was such a simple action, but it caused such an extraordinary reaction within Julia. A rush of fire shot up her arm and spread rapidly within her body, causing the baby hairs on the back of her neck to prickle.
"Why don't we take this wine through to the living room?" Barker asked, already standing. "The couch might be a little comfier."
Julia attempted to reply, but she suddenly had a frog in her throat. She coughed and nodded, scooping up her wine glass. She followed Barker through to the dimly lit living room, and they sat next to each other on the couch. He leaned forward, and using a long lighter, he lit three untouched candles in a glass stand on the clutter-free coffee table.
"Quite ingenious to have a date in my cottage," Barker said, darting his brows up and down. "No worry of being interrupted."
Julia coughed again and gulped down her wine quickly. Red wine wasn't her favourite, but it had been a long and busy week, and it was taking the edge off. Every time she was with Barker, she felt inexplicably nervous, something she had never felt with Gerard. When she had explained this to Sue, her sister had been adamant those feelings were love, but Julia was sure it was too soon to feel something so strong.
"It's been a lovely evening," Julia said, perching on the edge of the couch. "You should cook more often. You're quite good at it."
"I'll take that as a compliment," Barker chuckled softly, spreading his arm across the back of the leather couch. "You'll have to teach me some of your cake recipes. Something simple to get me started."
Barker's fingers suddenly danced across the back of Julia's arms, resting on her shoulder. Her body stiffened, but she couldn't deny she liked the feeling of Barker's hands on her. Sipping her wine, she allowed herself to lean into his masculine chest. "A Victoria sponge cake is always a good place to start," she said, the shake in her voice obvious. "Or a classic scone?"
"Sounds delicious," Barker said, looking down into her eyes. "You're a kind woman, Julia. I really like you."
"I like you too, Detective Inspector."
"No," Barker said softly, shaking his head a little as he laughed. "I really like you."
Barker rested his glass of red wine on the square couch arm and hooked his finger under Julia's chin. They stared deeply into each other's eyes, their faces so close she could smell Barker's musky aftershave on his neck. Gulping, she blinked slowly, noticing that she was edging closer to his lips.
"I really like you too," Julia whispered, her fingers clutching the wine glass so tightly she was sure it was about to shatter.
Barker's hand slid from her chin to the side of her face, his fingers touching the edge of her hair and his palm cupping her cheek. She closed her eyes, smiling as Barker's soft lips and stubbly chin brushed against her. She didn't have time to savour the moment because of a sudden banging at the door startled them both. Barker jumped back, knocking his red wine and drenching the front of his crisp white shirt. Cursing out, he stood up and let the wine drip to the white fluffy rug under the glass coffee table. It almost resembled blood.
"Who's that, at this time of night?" Barker mumbled angrily as he headed into the hallway, flicking wine off his hands.
Julia placed her own wine on the table and stood up, observing herself in the mirror above the fireplace. Her hair was a little ruffled. Her berry-tinted lips were slightly smudged from Barker's kiss, and her eyes were a little blurry from the never-ending glass of red wine. Julia had barely finished straightening herself up before Jessie burst into the room.
"Tommy just called," Jessie said gravely, staring deeply into Julia's eyes, thankfully not seeming to notice what she'd just interrupted.
"Somebody else has just died. We need to get there, now."
"I've been drinking," Julia said reactively. "We both have."
"I'll call a taxi," Barker said, appearing behind Jessie. "Let me go and change my shirt and I'll be right back."
Barker rushed past them both and along the hallway to his bedroom. Through a crack in the door, Julia watched as Barker pulled off his stained shirt. Shaking her head, she turned her attention back to Jessie.
"Do you know who has died?" Julia asked, resting her hand on her forehead as she attempted to steady her thoughts.
"Mac,"
Jessie said darkly, her bottom lip trembling.
"The guitar guy."
Chapter 6. The taxi ride to Fenton Industrial Park was a long and uncomfortable one. Barker sat in the front seat, slapping the dashboard every time they stopped at a traffic light, demanding loudly that the taxi driver speed through them. Despite Barker flashing his badge at the driver more than once, the man barely registered any acknowledgement. In the back seat, Julia held Jessie as she sobbed silently, dampening Julia's shoulder. She stroked the girl's back, trying her best to soothe her. The more she focused on Jessie's tears, the easier it was to hold back her own. She'd only talked to the musician at the beginning of the week. She couldn't believe such a talented young man, with a staunchly positive outlook on his bleak situation, was no longer among the living. She couldn't wrap her head around the injustice. When they pulled up outside the industrial park, behind two parked police cars, Barker didn't wait for the taxi to stop before he tossed the money at the driver and jumped out. Julia apologised on his behalf, but once again the driver barely flinched. Practically cradling Jessie, Julia helped her out of the car. Two paramedics walked by carrying a stretcher wrapped in a red blanket, so she clasped Jessie's head to her chest to shield her from seeing such a thing. Julia, on the other hand, couldn't look away. As they put Mac's body into the back of the ambulance, a tear rolled down her cheek when she saw his dark, scruffy hair poking out.
"Jessie!"
Tommy cried, hobbling out of the industrial park.
"Oh, you poor thing! Come here!"
Jessie let go of Julia and ran into the old man's arms. Balancing on his stick, he wrapped his free arm around her and rested his cheek on her head as he stroked the back of her hair.
"What happened, Tommy?"
Julia asked, resting her hand on the old man's shoulder.
"It's the exact same thing,"
Tommy yelled, casting his stick towards the fence where Barker was talking to two uniformed officers.
"Those pigs won't listen to me. They don't care if we live or die."
Julia set off towards Barker, her stomach knotting when she saw Mac's guitar lying on the floor in the corner where she'd listened to him playing only days ago, its neck broken and half of its strings snapped.
"He's been dead a good 12 hours, she heard one of the officers tell Barker. "There's nothing to suggest any foul play. You know what it's like with these people."
Barker grumbled a reply, but he didn't correct the officer. He walked around to the sleeping bag, pulling it open a little and peering inside.
"And this is where you found him?"
Barker asked, letting go of the sleeping bag and standing back up.
"In his sleeping bag?" "If you ask me, boss, he was a junkie, like the rest of 'em, and took it too far,"
the other officer said. "They're dropping like flies."
"He wasn't on drugs," Julia said, clearing her throat and stepping forward. "I spoke to him a couple of days ago, and he told me he didn't touch them. He was a guitar player."
"Aren't you a little dressed up to be homeless, love?" one of the officers said, smirking as he looked her up and down.
"I'm not homeless," Julia said sternly, pursing her lips and planting her hands on her hips.
"Did you know he is the fourth man to die in this exact same place in the last month?"
"I was aware of that,"
the older officer said, hooking his thumbs into his belt and cocking his head back. "But none of them died suspiciously as far as we're concerned."
"You're telling me there's nothing suspicious about four men dying, three of whom with inconclusive causes of death, and if I had to bet on it, a fourth one to be added to that same list?"
Julia walked over to the fence and touched the movable panels.
"If you ask me, that's the most suspicious thing I've ever heard."
"Well, nobody asked you, love," the younger officer snickered, rolling his eyes at Barker.
"Get out of here."
"Don't talk to her like that," Barker said firmly, his jaw flinching. "Julia, go and wait with Jessie." The two officers suddenly straightened up and tossed their gazes to the ground.
"Somebody needs to take this seriously, Barker,"
Julia pleaded.
"This is beyond coincidence now. Three men might have been able to slide, but four? I'd bet my cafe that these men were murdered."
The older officer sighed heavily, rolling his eyes at the younger officer, his head still dropped. Julia was used to members of the police force underestimating her.
"Those fence panels move," Julia said, undeterred by the officers. "I know for a fact that three of the men all died up and down this fence. My theory is that whoever is murdering these men, they're squeezing through this gap in the fence and somehow killing them while they sleep."
"And how do you suppose they're doing that?" the younger officer sneered, barely holding back his laughter.
"The kiss of death? These men weren't strangled, smothered or stabbed. There's no cause of death. And besides, that gap is tiny. Only a tiny woman or child would fit through there."
Julia grabbed hold of the young officer's arm and pulled him towards the fence. Reaching over the tall man, she pried apart the metal panels and pushed him through. The front of his uniform snagged the metal, but he fit.
"All right, lady," the officer cried, pulling himself free of Julia and pushing down his jacket. "I get your point.
Tell me this then, Sherlock. Why would anybody want to kill random homeless people in their sleep?
Because the human condition isn't predictable or logical, officer, Julia said calmly, making sure to retain the skeptic's gaze. The question here shouldn't be why, but how. How are these poor, innocent men being murdered? And what are you doing to catch whoever it is before a fifth man is discovered?
Both officers looked at each other, each of them seemingly lost for words. The older officer's jaw flapped, but he didn't speak. Out of the corner of her eye, she caught Barker smirking. Before either of them answered, a call came in over the radio, and they doubled back, shaking their heads as they walked away.
You know, he could have arrested you for pushing him through a fence like that, Barker said. Technically, you just assaulted an officer of the law.
I know, she said, shrugging and staring firmly at the men as they walked towards the exit. Technically, those men are idiots.
I couldn't have protected you if they carted you off to the station, Barker whispered into her ear as they followed the officers towards the gates.
I can look after myself, Detective Inspector, Julia said. If the police aren't going to take this seriously, somebody has to. And if that person has to be me, so be it.
Barker shook his head and pinched between his brows. He let out a heavy sigh, but he didn't try to dissuade her. They both knew nothing he could say could make her back down.
Do you know who found him? Julia asked Tommy, who was sitting at the edge of the curb with Jesse where the ambulance had been. I'd like to speak to them.
Cindy, Tommy said, hobbling to his feet with Jesse's help. She's at Stella and Max's soup kitchen a couple of miles away. They were here with their food truck when she found him. So they went and opened up, especially for them. Most followed on, but I hung back to wait for you.
I'll call a taxi, Julia said as she dug in her handbag for her phone. I'll make sure to call a different one, Barker. I don't think that driver would appreciate seeing you again.
Chapter 7 Stella and Max Moon's soup kitchen was tucked away on a dark back street, sandwiched between a boarded-up nightclub and a 24-hour off-licence. Just like Fenton Industrial Park, it was tucked away on the outskirts of town, hidden from view.
"They're good people," Tommy said, as they all climbed out of the taxi. "Good Christian people."
"I didn't even know places like this existed out here," Barker mumbled, almost under his breath. Julia detected the tinge of guilt in his voice.
"Most people don't," Jesse replied flatly.
"That's the problem." Inside of the soup kitchen, an eerie silence clouded the air. Groups of people sat around tables, some of them whispering, some of them rolling cigarettes and drinking from beer cans. But most were staring blankly ahead. Julia sensed their fear and hopelessness.
"We need to help these people," Julia whispered to Barker as they followed Tommy across the vast space. "This can't happen again."
"Let's just see what this woman says," he whispered back, resting his hand in the small of her back. "It'll be okay."
Julia wanted to believe him, but she wasn't sure. The more time she spent in this world, the more she realized how ignored and disregarded the people living in it were. At the end of the day, she could go home to her warm cottage, take a hot bath, and sleep in a comfortable bed. She had never felt more grateful for her privilege than she had in the last week.
"Cindy," Tommy said quietly, as he approached a table where a nervous-looking woman sat. "Can we sit down?"
"Free country," she said,
sniffling and wiping her nose with the back of her hand.
"Who are the well-dressed folks?"
"These are my friends," Tommy said, smiling at Julia, who in turn smiled at Cindy. "You remember Jesse, don't you? Julia here has taken her into her home. And this is her boyfriend, Barker. He's a detective. Detective Inspector."
Barker corrected him, and I'm not here on official business. They sat at the table as Cindy tucked her scraggly blonde hair behind her ears. Julia would have guessed they were similar ages, but years on the street had taken their toll on the woman. Her eyes were sunken, her teeth were stained, and her nose was red raw.
"Tommy told me you found Mac," Julia said softly, leaning across the table to Cindy. "That must have been difficult."
"I told the police all I know," she snapped back, tucking her bony knees up into her chest and clutching them with her hands. "I don't know nothing. I just thought he was sleeping. I went to wake him up to see if he had any money. He was good like that. He always gave me a couple of quid to get some cans or whatever. He'd been sleeping all day, but that's not unusual, you know. There's not much else to do. I've never been a good sleeper myself. My mum used to say I'd wake if the wind changed direction. I put my hand on him, but he didn't move. He was stiff as a board. I pulled back his sleeping bag and I knew he was dead. Not the first body I've seen. Probably won't be the last either, if you know what I'm saying."
"Did you see anything suspicious?" Julia asked.
"I told the police what I told them," she said again, wiping her runny nose with the back of her hand. "I said to them that I saw marks on his arm, but I told them, I said, Mac doesn't touch drugs. He wasn't like that. He was a good kid."
Julia looked down at the woman's arms as she scrambled to tuck her hair behind her ears. She noticed tiny red marks littering the inside of her forearm. She glanced to Barker, and he seemed to have noticed them too, and they both appeared to think the same thing at the same time. Whatever she told them couldn't be guaranteed to be entirely reliable.
"She's right," Tommy said. "Mac was clean. He was against all of that stuff."
"Are you sure you saw some marks on his arm?" Julia asked, lowering her voice and leaning in.
"Absolutely sure. I saw what I saw, lady."
Julia pulled back, glancing awkwardly at Barker, who shrugged. At that moment, Stella Moon walked over and placed a plate of pale golden toast smothered in butter on the table. Cindy dove in immediately.
"We didn't have any ingredients for soup left, so I tossed some bread in the toaster,"
Stella said softly, clutching the tiny silver crucifix around her neck.
"How are you feeling, Cindy?"
"Sad,"
Cindy said, as she crammed a second slice of toast into her already full mouth.
"Hungry."
Stella smiled sadly at the woman before turning and heading back to the counter, where her husband Max was opening a new loaf of bread. Stella appeared to be in her early 40s, but she dressed like a woman more like Julia's gran's age. She was wearing a pleated calf-length skirt, a lilac cardigan, and thick, clumpy shoes. Her long, mousy brown hair was scraped off her makeup-free face in a loose ponytail at the base of her neck. Unstylish, functional glasses balanced on the edge of her slender nose. Aside from the small crucifix on a simple chain around her neck, she wasn't wearing any jewellery.
"Somebody murdered him, if you ask me," Cindy mumbled through a mouthful of toast. "Injected something into him."
"It's the government,"
the man, who Tommy had referred to as Alcoholic Pete, said, staggering towards their table with a can of beer clutched in his hand.
"They're experimenting on us, testing a new supervirus."
"Leave off, Pete," Tommy cried, rolling his eyes heavily.
"It's true,"
Pete cried, slapping his hands on the table and sloshing his beer on Julia's dress.
"You heard the lady, puncture marks. Mac wasn't like that. And neither was the priest."
Julia remembered what Tommy had told her about Pete finding Michael Finn's body. She hadn't been brave enough to approach Pete to ask him questions, but now that he was here volunteering information, drunk or not, she knew it was her chance to ask questions.
"Did you find puncture marks on Father Thind?" Julia asked.
"What's it to you?"
Pete slurred, pointing in Julia's face and glancing up and down her body.
"Make it worth my while."
Barker pulled out his wallet and slapped a £20 note on the table and pushed it towards Pete. Pete and Cindy's eyes lit up.
"Tell the woman what you know," Barker said.
"He had three holes in his arm,"
Pete said sternly.
tucking the note deep in his pocket. Looked like somebody was trying to find a vein.
And you don't think it was Michael doing that to himself? Barker asked.
He was a man of God, Cindy replied. Course not.
Michael was as straight edge as they came, Pete offered, leaning against the table. Wouldn't even touch booze. I told him he was missing out, but he wouldn't listen. I told the police this, but they didn't listen either.
I'm not surprised, Tommy muttered bitterly. Clear off, Pete.
I'm talking to the nice lady, Peter cried, sloshing his can in Tommy's direction. Not you, old man.
Tommy mumbled something under his breath before standing up and hobbling across the canteen to another table.
Old fool thinks he runs things, Pete said. He's not so squeaky clean.
Don't you say a bad word against him, Jesse said, jumping up.
The prodigal daughter returns, Pete sneered. And here I was, thinking the aliens had got you too.
Jesse rolled her eyes and joined Tommy on the other table. They both glanced over their shoulder, glaring at Pete.
Are you sure you saw puncture marks? Julia asked, eager to get back on track.
I'm sure, Pete said firmly. The government injected him with something, just like the others. They're trying to wipe us out, but we won't go down without a fight.
Why would the government want to kill homeless people? Barker asked, clearly not taking Pete seriously.
To get rid of us, Pete said, as though it was an obvious answer. They've been trying to get rid of us for years. I'm going outside for a ciggy. Are you coming, Cindy?
Cindy nodded, cramming the last slice of toast into her mouth. She untucked her knees and scurried out of her seat, following Pete towards the door. Julia turned to Barker, but it was clear they weren't on the same page.
Please tell me you don't believe any of that, do you? Barker asked with a heavy sigh, clearly wanting to laugh.
It's the ramblings of a drunk. Neither of them can be believed.
What if they're on the right track? Julia asked, lowering her voice and leaning in.
The whole bit about the government and the aliens is nonsense. But what if they're right about the injections? I spoke to Mac myself and saw him with my own two eyes. He wasn't on drugs. What if this is the cause of death?
Lethal injection? Barker asked, pursing his lips. But why?
I don't know that yet, but this is the best lead we have.
You're talking like a detective, Barker said, smirking a little.
Someone has to, Julia said, glancing over to Jesse. You saw how little those officers cared. Somebody has to do something. You have to admit things don't add up.
They don't, Barker agreed. But there's not a lot I can do. If these deaths are being ruled as non-suspicious, it's going to be difficult for anyone to try and get somebody in the force to listen. The last thing any of them want is to admit that there might be a serial killer out there.
We don't need the force, Julia said.
No offence.
None taken.
We can crack this, Barker.
Julia reached out and grabbed his hand in hers. You and me, the minute we have something concrete, you can take it to your boss and be the hero.
It's not about that, Julia. I'm worried about you.
It'll be fine, she said quickly, letting go of his hands.
You always say that, but you have a habit of putting yourself in danger, and it scares me.
Don't worry about me, Julia said, as she peered around the full canteen. It's these people we need to worry about. Are you in?
Barker exhaled heavily through his nose. He looked around the canteen, his eyes pausing on Jesse as she chatted with Tommy. He turned back to Julia and picked up her hands.
I'll do what I can, Barker said.
Within the law.
That's good enough for me, Julia said, concealing her smile as she stood up. Go and make sure Jesse is okay. I'm going to talk to Sally and Max. They're at the industrial park a lot, and they might have seen something.
Why do I feel like you've just become my boss?
You say that like it's a bad thing, Julia whispered, winking as she turned around.
Julia left Barker and walked over to the counter where Stella and Max were buttering fresh slices of toast. They both looked up and smiled meekly at Julia as she leaned against the counter and waited for them to finish.
"You're the donuts and coffee lady, aren't you?" Stella asked, peering over her glasses at Julia with a soft smile. "It's nice to see another Christian woman."
"Oh, I'm not Christian," Julia corrected her. "I don't think so, anyway. I believe in something, I think. I'm just not quite sure."
"God is all around," Max said, smiling in the same soft way as he buttered the final slice of toast. "There are many roads to him. Just because you don't put the label on it doesn't mean you don't believe."
"Maybe," Julia said. "I just wanted to say that I really admire what you both do for these people."
"We're doing what we can to make the world a better place," Stella said, putting down the butter knife and opening the door to the kitchen. "Come through."
Julia thanked her and walked into the brightly lit kitchen. It was three times bigger than her own cafe's kitchen, and she couldn't help but think how much easier it would be to bake in such a space, even if it was a little run down.
"Is it just you two here?" Julia asked.
"We sometimes have volunteers helping out, but it's just us most of the time," Max said, turning and leaning against the counter. "We're a non-profit organisation. We get a little money from the government, but we stay open mostly from the donations of kind people in the local community. Sorry, I didn't catch your name."
"Julia," she said with a kind smile. "Julia South."
"It's lovely to meet you, Julia," Stella said, holding her hand out. "If you'd ever want to, we'd love to have you volunteer here."
"I'd love to," Julia said. "I own a cafe over in Perrydale, so I could bring over some ingredients and whip something up."
"The people would really love that," Max said as he shook her hand. "I sometimes think they get tired of soup, but it's the only way we can make the most of the ingredients. Most of the stuff we get is what the greengrocers and supermarkets send on when things are ready for throwing away. We toss a lot out, because it's already gone bad by the time it gets to us. But we do the best we can with the little we have."
"From what I've heard, the people really appreciate it. I actually wanted to ask you guys a question about the industrial park. You seem to be there quite a lot, and I was just wondering if you'd seen anything that might be of use."
"Like what?" Stella asked, her brow furrowing slightly as she glanced at Max.
"Connected to the recent murders?"
Julia said.
"Murders?" Max looked to his wife, his brows furrowing. "I thought the police said there was no foul play."
"That's what they think, but I have reason to think there's something darker going on."
"That's terrible," Stella whispered, as she clutched the cross around her neck. "I'm sorry, but I don't think we can help you. We pull up outside, serve soup and leave. We only see what comes to the window of our food truck."
"I thought as much," Julia said, nodding firmly. "It was worth a shot, at least."
"Are you working with the police?" Max asked.
"Not quite. They don't quite believe my theories yet, so I'm trying to piece together as much as I can before it happens again."
"We'll pray for you," Stella said, clutching Max's hands. "Be safe, Julia."
Julia assured them that she would, and promised she would be back on Sunday with her ingredients to volunteer. On her way out, she spotted a framed newspaper clipping on the wall from the Cheltenham Standard. The headline read, "Local Heroes Help the Homeless," along with a picture of Stella and Max with a teenage girl standing outside of the soup kitchen. After scanning the first couple of lines of the article, she realised it was their daughter. Glad that there were still good people out there in the world, she smiled to herself and rejoined Barker, Jessie and Tommy.
"How would you like a hot shower and a roof over your head tonight?" Julia asked Tommy, as she sat down in between him and Barker.
"It's only my old couch, but I'm sure it's comfier than your doorway."
"Bless you, Julia," Tommy said, clutching her hands appreciatively. "You're an angel."
Barker called for a taxi and they all walked outside. When they were on the curb, waiting for the taxi to take them all back to Perrydale, Barker leaned in to Julia.
"I thought you could come back to mine to tuck into that trifle you brought," he said. "Finish our date."
"Another time,"
Julia said. Jesse needs me right now. I give you permission to eat my portion. Barker chuckled softly and wrapped his arm around Julia's shoulder. It felt foreign to have a man's arm around her, but she quite liked it. She grabbed Barker's hand and leaned into him. Tonight, she realized how much she appreciated him and everything else in her life. When the taxi pulled up, Barker climbed in the front, and Tommy and Jesse climbed into the back. Before getting into the car, Julia looked back at the soup kitchen, but movement in the shadows of the closed nightclub caught her eye. She spotted Pete and Cindy talking to a hooded man. Pete passed over a £20 note Barker had given him, and the man handed over a needle. Pausing and clinging on to the car door, Julia had to stop herself from going over to slap the needle out of their hands. But she knew she couldn't help them all. Tonight she was helping Tommy, and that had to be enough.
Chapter 8. Freshly showered and shaved, Tommy sat in front of the roaring fire, wearing a badly fitting, fluffy pink bathrobe. It had been a Christmas present from Sue that Julia hadn't gotten around to forcing herself to wear, so she was glad she could finally find a use for it.
"I feel like a new man," Tommy said, as he ran his fingers along his clean jawline. "I underestimated the power of a hot shower."
"You look so much younger," Jessie said, as she sat cross-legged on the hearthrug, picking at it with her fingers. "I've never seen you without a beard."
"I don't think I've seen myself without one for years," Tommy said, leaning up and looking in the mirror above the fire again. "Quite handsome, if I do say so myself."
"Your clothes shouldn't be too long," Julia said, as she heard her two-in-one washing machine and tumble dryer click from the washing to the drying function. "Although, I must say, that colour does suit you."
"I think it does too," Tommy said, winking in Jessie's direction. "Imagine what the guys would say if they saw me now. I can't thank you enough for letting me into your home, Julia. You truly are a modern-day saint."
"I'm just sorry I can't do more," Julia said, trying to smile, despite not feeling very saint-like. "You're welcome to sleep on my couch for as long as you need to."
"No need," Tommy said, shaking his head and waving his hands. "One night will do me just fine. I won't impose. You've done more than enough taking this one in."
Tommy reached out and gently ruffled Jessie's hair. She smiled softly and leaned her cheek on his knee as she stared at Tommy, as though she was looking at a grandfather she adored. Julia recognised that look. It was the look of a girl who longed for a family of her own, and Tommy was as close to that as she had come. They stayed up chatting until the fire died down and the clock had gone past 1 in the morning. When Julia noticed Tommy starting to yawn, she suggested they all retire for the night, something Jessie seemed reluctant to do. After Julia dug out her spare duvet from under the bed, Tommy tucked himself up in front of the flickering embers in the grate of the fire, still snuggled in the pink bathrobe.
"Good night, little one," he said sleepily to Jessie. "Sweet dreams."
Jessie wandered off to her bedroom, a definite sadness hanging over her. Julia went to her own bedroom and changed into the matching fluffy pink pyjamas for the first time. She looked in the mirror, at the hanging sleeves and trailing legs, wondering why her sister thought she would like such things. Chuckling softly to herself, she crept out of her bedroom and along the hall towards Jessie's. Against the soft hum of the tumble dryer, Tommy could be heard softly snoring.
"Jessie," Julia whispered through the door, "are you still awake?"
There was a long pause. Julia could tell Jessie was thinking whether or not she should respond.
"Yeah," she replied. "Can I come in? It's your house."
Julia carefully opened the door, not wanting the creaky old hinges to wake Tommy. She winced as an ear-splitting creak echoed around the cottage. Sitting cross-legged on top of the covers, Jessie was flicking through a cookbook, looking at the pictures but not reading any of the words. Mowgli looked up from his comfy spot at the bottom of the bed, blinked at Julia,
then tucked his face back under his giant tail.
"I found him snuggled in my laundry basket," Jessie said, reaching out to gently stroke Mowgli's head. "Thought he might be comfier on the bed."
Purring deeply, Mowgli rolled over and arched his back so Jessie could rub his belly. He only did that for people he really liked.
"He's taken quite a shine to you," Julia said, sitting on the edge of the bed to join in the stroking. "He's cool. I always wanted a cat."
Julia smiled to herself as she stared down at Mowgli. It was just another thing she hadn't known about Jessie. Just like she had on her date with Barker, she was beginning to realise how little she knew about the people in her life. It wasn't a feeling she liked. "Great Cakes of the East," Julia read aloud from the front of the cookbook. "Another library book?" Jessie nodded, the messy bun on the top of her head bouncing. She didn't take her attention away from Mowgli. "Anything interesting in here?" Julia flicked through the beautifully illustrated pages.
"I don't understand most of the words," Jessie admitted. "Too complicated. I was trying to think of something to impress you, and then you might want to put it in the cafe."
"You already impressed me, Jessie. You've made a lot of progress with your baking."
"I'm not as good as you, though."
"You will be one day," Julia assured her. "A bit more practice, and you'll be even better than me." Jessie smiled appreciatively as she took the cookbook back from Julia. She continued to flick through the pages, poring over the photographs. It hadn't gone unnoticed by Julia that Jessie had some trouble reading recipes in the cafe.
"There's something I've been wanting to ask you ever since we first met," Julia started, trying her best to sound casual as she tickled under Mowgli's chin. "Considering everything that's happening right now, I don't think I'll be able to sleep another night without knowing the truth."
"The truth about what?" Jessie asked, looking suspiciously down her nose in a way only she could do.
"About your past."
Jessie immediately looked down and started fiddling with the fraying hem of her pyjama bottoms. She managed to grab a thread with her chomped-down nails and began to pull.
"What's there to know?" Jessie asked, her brows pinching tightly as she carelessly unravelled the stitching.
"Well, I don't really know much." Julia rearranged herself so that she was sitting cross-legged, mirroring Jessie exactly.
"All I really know is that your parents died when you were a baby. You grew up in foster care, and then you ran away, and I found you in my cafe."
"Sounds like you already know everything," Jessie mumbled, snapping off the long thread and wrapping it around her index finger.
"They're just facts. You can know a recipe, but it doesn't mean you can bake a cake. I want to know more about Jessie and how things affected her."
"Nothing's affected me."
"Why don't you start with your childhood?"
Jessie wrapped the thread tightly around the end of her finger and waited until it turned bright red before unravelling it. She exhaled deeply and looked at Julia, her lips pursed and her eyes narrowed. She looked more comfortable than Julia had ever seen her.
"My mum and dad died in a car crash," Jessie said in a matter-of-fact voice. "I was in the car too, but I somehow survived. They say it was because of my car seat, and that it was a miracle. Didn't feel much like a miracle to be alive. I was in a system from 3 months old."
"That must have been tough.
I was a baby," Jessie said, rolling her eyes. "I don't remember any of it. My first memory was being with this really nice old couple. I thought they were my parents, until they told me they weren't, and that they were retiring from fostering. I didn't understand why they couldn't keep me. It wasn't until later I realised they could. They just didn't want to. I was the last of 27 children they had fostered. I must have been a bad baby."
"I don't think that's true," Julia said softly, resting her hand on Jessie's.
"Perhaps they were just too old to look after a little girl. I don't doubt they thought they were doing what was best for you."
"Well, it wasn't," Jessie snapped, pulling her hand from Julia's and tossing the thread. "I was 4 when I went back into care. People only want babies. I bounced from foster home to foster home, but everything was only temporary. When I thought I'd found somewhere nice,
I'd be turfed back into the care homes. I was always too difficult or too loud. I never got on with the other kids.
Is that why you ran away?
Jessie laughed softly, shaking her head. She looked up at the dark ceiling and then to the soft lamp on the bedside table, her gaze distant.
The last family I got put with weren't very nice, Jessie said, still staring blankly at the light bulb. Kelly and Tim. Along the way, I met some okay foster parents, but these were the worst of the worst. I don't know how they got approved. It was clear they just did it for the money. Kelly was always at work, and Tim was a drunk. There were 5 kids. 2 of them were theirs, and the others were foster kids. He never hit his own kids. The others just took it, but I was never like that. I told my social worker, but she didn't believe me. She just thought I was being difficult. So I packed my bag, nicked his wallet, and ran.
That must have been hard.
Hard? Jessie scoffed, shaking her head. That was the easiest decision I've ever made. The second I left, I was free of being in that messed up system. I slept rough for weeks, and then I met Tommy at the soup kitchen. He took me to Fenton, so I wasn't on my own. Took me under his wing like no other foster parent had. There wasn't anything in it for him either. He didn't need to be nice to me. I felt at home there. It wasn't easy, but we got by. It was a long winter, and the older ones were dying all the time. But Tommy looked after me. We helped each other. Until what? Julia urged.
Until I abandoned him, Jessie cried, her sudden loudness waking Mowgli. I abandoned all of them because you offered me something better. What kind of person does that make me?
A survivor.
But look what's happening to them now, Jessie cried so loud. Mowgli jumped up and scurried for the closed door. They're barely surviving.
That's not your fault.
I know, Jessie whispered, dropping her head again. I feel so guilty because I love the life you've given me. It's the life I always dreamt of but never thought I'd have. You've given me hope, Cake Lady.
Jessie's words took Julia so much by surprise that she didn't have time to stop the tears gathering the corner of her eyes. She wiped them away before grabbing both of Jessie's hands.
You have a home here for as long as you want, Julia said, squeezing tightly. I promise.
Jessie pulled her hands away and turned back to the lamp, tears collecting in the corners of her own eyes. She furiously wiped them away with her sleeve, her lips curling downwards.
I've heard that before, she said bitterly. They say they care until they have babies of their own, and then they don't care enough to keep you around. You've got Barker.
We're only dating, Julia said, trying her best to sound reassuring. No matter what happens, it won't change anything.
Everything changes, Jessie said bleakly. Change can be good. Look at you and me. Before I met you, I was rattling around in this cottage alone. You've given me as much as I've given you. When I wake up in the morning, just seeing you here puts a smile on my face.
Really?
I wouldn't say it if I didn't mean it.
I know, Jessie said with a nod.
You're an honest woman.
Most of the time.
Most of the time?
Jessie smirked a little, wiping the last of her tears away. She looked over to Mowgli as he noisily scratched underneath the door.
You said you and Barker were just dating.
But he's clearly in love with you, Jessie said, meeting Julia's eyes properly since the first time she'd sat down.
You don't see the way he looks at you when you're not looking.
Julia smiled nervously, her heart suddenly fluttering in her chest. She tried to deny it, but she didn't know what to say. Jessie was only a teenager, but she was more observant and receptive than people twice her age. She thought about the kiss they had shared earlier in the night, before being interrupted by Jessie. She remembered the frustration she had felt when he had pulled away. She had wanted it to last forever.
I should go to bed, Julia said. Early start in the morning. Saturdays are always busy.
Jessie nodded and climbed into bed,
Julia tucked her in and kissed her on the forehead, and they both smiled at each other. She wasn't the girl's mother, but she knew she'd just become the next best thing, and she liked that. Jessie had filled a void in her life she hadn't even realised she had.
"Julia, can I ask you something?" Jessie asked as Julia reached out for the doorknob. "Do you